I only have part of a voice left after running four games and shouting at game players in both on the first day and in the games fair, so if I sound a bit hoarse, that's why. I'm talking today about gaming peace and stabilization operations, and as you'll see in a minute, I'm going to tend to emphasize the sorts of things which I think those games should include, and a little less on the particular techniques that might include them, although I will say something on that as well. But obviously, since we're here at a conference at KCL talking about wargaming, I need to start with the obligatory reference to Carl von Clausewitz, who, as you all know, of course, wrote in On War that in the whole range of human activities, war most resembles a game of cards. There's a little asterisk down there because, of course, it was actually Marie von Braal who published the book, not Carl von Clausewitz, so we should perhaps remember that. But what is also often not known is that von Clausewitz was working on a second book, a sequel to On War, called On Peace and Stabilization Operations. Which was never published because he never finished the drafts. And we have his drafts of the various iterations of On Peace and Stabilization Operations, which give us some insight into Carl's thinking. So the Clausewitzians in the audience will appreciate this. He noted, of course, that in the range of human activities, peace operations most resemble a game of cards. But he modified that later to add a game of cards with lots and lots of players, you see, not really kind of two-sided classic Total War. But that didn't quite capture it, so in the next edition of his notes, we can see he scrawled it in, who don't really trust each other. So that in the whole range of human activities, peace operations most resemble a game of cards with lots and lots of players who don't really trust each other. But that didn't quite capture it, so he added, and several different and simultaneous games of cards with different rules and lots of players who don't really trust each other. But still, he wasn't quite there, and as we know, Carl was a perfectionist. In which he added, the trick is actually not to fight if you can possibly help it. So it's a little different from on war there. That's hence the title on peace and stabilization operations. And of course, obviously with extra helpings of fog and friction and interagency and coalition. And so he reworked his classic dictum there. He reworked several of his other classic and famous dictums. We all know that war is the continuation of policy by other means, you know, the intensely political purposes of war. But in talking about peace operations, he added that seriously, peace operations are so intensely political that every little thing like the shape of the dam, meeting table, or the name of a city on a map, or who your mother was suddenly becomes a potential political crisis. Lest you think Carl is exaggerating, when I was doing work with the World Bank, we had a 47-country donor conference that had been 6 months in the planning, multiple millions of dollars in support of what we then amusingly called the Middle East peace process, fall apart because the Israeli side didn't like the fact that Al-Quds of Jerusalem was on the Palestinian map of the West Bank and insisted that the Palestinians remove Jerusalem, and the Palestinians refused to. It was one page of, I believe, an 85-page, incredibly boring economic planning meeting. And the entire conference had to be canceled, it's a consultative group meeting, because of one word on one page of a map. And what's more, the State Department was so upset at the World Bank as if it was their fault that there was never, ever a consultative group meeting on the Palestinian Authority ever held again. So Carl was quite right that things like the shape of the table or names on a map or who your mother was can in fact be intensely sensitive. And then, of course, don't even get Carl started on strategic corpus. So with that in mind, with Carl having warned us in his great unpublished work on peace and stabilization operations, I thought what I would do today is simply provide you with the top seven things to remember when gaming peace and stabilization operations. And I'll give you the seven, and then we'll go through them one at a time. Number seven, remember the Kobayashi Maru. Half of you will get the reference and half of you won't. Number six, hubris management. And I'll say quite a bit about hubris management. Number five, break the law of the instrument. Number four, balancing culture and common sense. Number three, strategic corporals who are never strategic corporals. At best, they're operational corporals, but we'll come back to that. Number two, everything is political. I'm a political scientist. I have a bias in that direction, but it's true nonetheless. And number one, it depends on what you are trying to do. And so if there's any takeaway, and it's wargaming or policy gaming or serious gaming 101, is it depends on what you are trying to do. So I'll go through these one at a time. So number one, with all serious game design, you need to start with the objectives, not with the game. What is it you are trying to do, and is a game the best way of doing that? And that's hugely important. Indeed, expanding that slightly, do you need a game at all? Yuna Wong circulated to some of her friends the famous BBC flowchart on mansplaining. No, she wasn't accusing me of mansplaining. She was, hopefully not. She was just sharing. But what we also need is a helpful flowchart on, do you really need a war game? That we can just send to people to follow through to decide if they really need a war game. Because I actually do spend a lot of time telling people, why are you doing that with the game? We have, in making the case for our field or our discipline or our guild or whatever on earth we are, I don't know what the collective noun is for a group of war gamers, we've tended to, I think, overemphasize gaming as a magic bullet that solves all things. And we have condemned BOGSATs as the worst thing in the universe. And the best, most inventive meetings I have been to in my entire professional career were Intel BOGSATs, bilats between Canada and the US, largely because the person who chaired them was just brilliant at eliciting views out of a group of people in a room. And he was far, he's actually a war gamer too. And of the view that war games are actually not very useful. But I'll leave that aside. But, you know, do you actually need a game? What is it you're trying to do? Are you trying to teach people about peace operations? And if so, what do they need to be taught? Are you using games analytically to develop approaches or specific policies for a particular problem you're going to address? And as you're thinking about all of that, you always need to be thinking, how much time do I have these people for? How much prep time do they have? What is the room like? Are there tables of the same height that can be moved? I mean, where are we going to have lunch? All that stuff practically has to come into it as well. Now, what I'll do is I'll highlight both some games that I use. I teach peace and stabilization operations, humanitarian operations at McGill, amongst other things, that I've used and why, in a sense, I've used them, and some other games that are really about peace and stabilization operations. So these are all ones that have been used at one time or another in my classroom. The one on the left, Anja van der Holst is running it because it's a TNO game on the comprehensive approach. It's you know, a rigid computer-assisted board game in which you're making decisions about where you want to spend resources, and those resources are affecting a variety of indicators. Famously, in that game, the insurgents managed to convince the NGOs to finance their illicit drug cultivation by dressing up as organic vegetables. Never trust undergraduate students. We've seen the provincial reconstruction game, because you run it here. It was run here. I've run a modified version of it as well. And I also ran Aftershock here, which is a game about sort of interagency cooperation in a humanitarian disaster. These are all rigid play board games or card games, short duration, a few hours. If they're much longer than that, they're kind of hard to fit into a teaching schedule. Therefore, small groups, which is great in some ways and a problem in others, because you know, my peace building class is 100 students. The class I'll be teaching next week on Middle East politics is 300. So, you know, though that sort of game may not be suitable for certain sorts of audiences. And they tend to be very programmed in the lessons that they are teaching. By their very nature, that's the nature of a rigid game. It is both an advantage and a weakness. I also run this monstrosity, which is the Civil War in Britannia, which sadly Britannia has had a civil war for 20 years at McGill now. It never quite gets solved. And this is 7 days, 12 hours a day with 120 participants whilst they are taking other classes. So at McGill during that week, you may see students suddenly slip out of the back of another professor's class because the ceasefire has broken down, and the SRSG immediately wants to meet with the force commander on what they're going to do about it. They tend to sit at the back of my colleagues' classes during that week. My colleagues are remarkably tolerant of the behavior of students in the sim. And really, the reason, and this is a giant game of free Kriegspiel. There are some rules for humanitarian assistance and some spreadsheets, so it's a little bit computer assisted in that sense. But largely, it's a massive negotiation game with free Kriegspiel adjudication. And the reason I do it is because it is very hard to communicate to students through readings or lectures why peace and stabilization operations don't work perfectly. Because the world is full of doctrine and lessons learned and best practices guides, and they read like recipe books. You know, do 1, 2, 3, 4, and that is how you do disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of combatants. Do 1 through 7, and your refugees will be repatriated. UN OCHA has a very good handbook on negotiating with armed groups, which works most of the time unless they shoot you. And so forth. There's lots of stuff, and students read it, and they say, okay, why can the grown-ups not do this? Because there seems to be this proliferation of how-to guides. So you put them in a situation where there's conflicting information and people don't cooperate properly and lots of people have ulterior motives and information is, there's a signal to noise ratio and there's an overload, and I stress them. One of my metrics here is the number of anxiety nightmares I have in my class at the end of the term. I have them report them. And then they make the same mistakes. You know, they make the same mistakes. They duplicate two development projects because they didn't talk to each other. They fail to recognize the political optics of something they're doing. They suddenly discover that their counterpart is playing them for a political gain and what have you. And making the same mistakes in arguably a more permissive environment, since they don't allow live fire on the McGill campus, highlights why it is that people, and they're the people who are going to be doing it in a few years, why the people who are actually doing it have difficulty doing it. And I do say in a few years, because one of the realities of working in the humanitarian field is that at 25, you may be the equivalent of a battalion commander, because the career trajectory is different. You deploy fast, then you burn out, and then you go to headquarters. So I run them through it precisely to overwhelm the realities of information and coalition behavior and so forth in order to provide another perspective on the reading material and the lectures. The government of Sweden now for 18 years, because it's Viking 18, has run these massive peacekeeping, peacebuilding exercises, which tend to emphasize large-scale staff exercise procedures, casts of hundreds of participants running for days and weeks, and kind of an emphasis on procedures, information flows coming in and out, decisions going out, and so on and so forth. You do not have to go big necessarily to offer insight, and in fact, at this point, I'll share a slide which suggests that many of us can just go home, because the best single peace and stabilization simulation, leaving aside the fact that it depends on what you're trying to do. But if you want people to get a sense of the dynamics of this, cost £1.99 and you can play on your phone. Which seriously, some of you are very doubtful, but Rebel Inc. is really, really good. And you should look at it not only because it's an extraordinarily good stabilization simulation, but because it's a brilliant piece of game design, because they get enormous complexity on a piece of screen real estate that's this size. Right? So if they can do that, they get all that information and make it playable and intuitive. Why is your game so difficult to understand? It's a terrific, terrific game, to the point that the World Bank and the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute and so forth are now flying the game developers around to talk to practitioners about the insights that game develops. It's a fictionalized Afghanistan. They couldn't make it real Afghanistan because you can't sell games in the app store about current conflict. So it's somewhere else that has a lot of poppies and desert and mountains and what have you. Another case, I've run games about peace processes that are policy games, that are designed to acquaint people with the things that might come up and assist them in contingency planning. So the one on the left is one of a whole series of game or slightly gamified things we did around The refugee component of Palestinian-Israeli peace negotiations back in the day when those counted for something. The one at the top is a humanitarian simulation we did for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which is the agency that deals with Palestinian refugees, in which the Commissioner General of the organization was played by the Commissioner General of the organization, which made it very easy to get buy-in. The one on the right was probably my favorite. Because of the one on the left, one of my interns from Chatham House, who is a Libyan Brit PhD student, Skyped me during the Libyan uprising against Gaddafi and asked if I'd fly into Benghazi on a stolen 737 to run a game. And so, like, who could say no to that? So I ran some games for the Transitional National Council during the Civil War. And the great thing, this is the only time in the Middle East you will see street vendors selling NATO flags. Okay, because everyone wanted to fly a NATO flag from their car. I mean, the cigarette kids were selling NATO flags. You'll notice there's a British one there. You'll notice there's no American one there. This upset the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, who did a formal request to the rebel leadership to find out why no one was selling American flags on the streets of Benghazi. There's a reason for this. The French flag is like super easy to make, so like Libyan grandmothers were sewing up French flags and making them. And there was a Libyan textile company that made British flags for the UK market before the war, so they already had them ready. But the American flag, they didn't have it already made up, and it's really hard to make if you're a Libyan grandmother, so there was a kind of supply-demand technological issue there, so hence no American flags. And I know this because I talked to the Libyans who had to investigate it and report it back to the Americans. The other cool thing in there, which has got nothing to do with gaming, is you'll see some Muppets waving Libya Hurriya, Free Libya flags, and that's because someone repurposed their Muppet production of children's onesies into revolutionary tack. There was no one in Benghazi. There was like this stupid Canadian academic, bunch of grizzled World Food Program people, and a bunch of very large Americans with crew cuts and large watches who would not tell you why they were there, and if you tried to talk to them in the hotel, would all go off mumbling and not explain why they were staying at the hotel. So depending on what you're trying to do, you may use very different game approaches. The Libyan one was essentially a scenario discussion. It wasn't worth doing a more complicated game. They just had to think about the problems they were going to have reestablishing civil order, which turned out to be right. The one at the top was a negotiation exercise, but with people role-playing stakeholders to address what might happen if the U.S. cut off funding for the agency, which it did. So I'll claim that as one of my prescient successes. Given that the peace process collapsed, all the one on the left is a failure, this was a case to force negotiators to think about things we thought they weren't thinking about in the negotiations. And that was really fixed to make sure certain issues came up so they could see if they were prepared for them. And certainly the feedback from the people who were actually doing the negotiation was it was quite useful in identifying things. But very different approaches depending on the audience. So cardinal rule one is it depends who your audience is and what you're trying to do. And that's the same for all game design. Everything is political. Politics is not a bug. It's not something that gets in the way of military operations or doing development or humanitarian operations. It is the whole reason for being in a peace and stabilization operation. It is the central thing. It is Clausewitz on steroids about the centrality of politics. And that means that if you have politics in your game, it has to make sense. It can't be that the locals are a bunch of weird people and there's nothing. I mean, there is an internal logic to the Brexit debate in the UK, which may not seem apparent at times. But if I was sitting in North Korea or Tehran or, in fact, anywhere in the world, looking at Brexit, I want to make sure that my actors had some understanding of why they're doing the things that they're doing, and that they're not just randomly deciding that morning. They may change their mind in the morning, but there is an internal logic, which is precisely why Brexit hasn't been managed, because those internal logics are competing with each other. That is hugely important. Players should understand and ideally internalize the logics, the payoffs, the incentive structures of their opponents. Not just, you're a crazy militia, you hate everyone, you want to shoot up the coalition. Why do you want to shoot up the coalition? If you don't want to shoot up the coalition, you know what? There has to be an internal logic that is understandable. This is from a game we did on religious conflict in urban areas, which is a disguised version of the Ayodhya Mosque incident in India. operational corporals, small things can create big problems. And generally in war game design, we think it's a bad practice to have a god's eye view in which a single person is able to micromanage platoons at the same time be the brigade commander. I would argue that in peace and stabilization operations, it is often useful to force senior officials to suddenly be that corporal on the checkpoint faced with a difficult situation, which if they call it wrong, will create a political situation. I think it's important people understand how difficult it is to deal with some of the day-to-day situations, because I think when you're at headquarters, you may not realize how much weight you're putting on individual squaddies to make the right call with no support on the spot. Culture and common sense. Games should accurately represent local cultural practices and perspectives without cultural stereotyping or othering. Iranians do not behave the same way. Not all of them. There's a huge, huge variation. So you need to highlight political diversity. Here's an example of a country where there's some diversity. A bunch of hunters and a bunch of hunt saboteurs. They don't all have exactly the same views because they live in the same country. They probably come from different social classes. They drink in separate pubs. Don't ask me how I know. And so on and so forth. You have to understand that there are professional subcultures too, and that aid workers and military folks may speak very different languages and see things through very different perspectives. So the difference may not be Iranians, Americans. It may be military officers and diplomats. There's a lot of evidence that globally diplomats have very similar ways of approaching problem sets, regardless of the country that they come from. So my interagency is full of eels. Some of you will get the reference about translating different perspectives. And be aware that actors will instrumentalize culture. They'll say, oh, we can't do that, it's against our culture. I mean, I once sat down with a bunch of senior generals from a Middle Eastern country who told us how against their culture democracy was as they knocked back Johnny Walker. And so they were a bit picking and choosing about what was culturally appropriate based on their own self-interest. And remember that common sense and empathy are as important as cultural knowledge. We do a lot of cultural training pre-deployment. I have a friend in the Marine Corps who did it, went out to Afghanistan and said, the most useful thing I ever learned was not to do the things that also pissed off my wife, because they tend to be universal. I'm sorry if you're upset apology, which doesn't work with your spouse, also doesn't work so well when you've blown someone's house up. A lot of these are human common sense. Your simulation, and I realize I'm running a bit over time, should break the law of the instrument. Oops, let me go back on that. In other words, there's a tendency for organizations to see every problem in terms of the things that they do. So scenarios should force participants, I don't know why I say that. I can't break the law at all. Scenarios should force participants to think out of their regular box and think about innovative solutions that are not the ones that they necessarily would have automatically brought to every problem. Hubris management. I think this is the most important thing we ever do in gaming, is hubris management. It's highlighting all the stuff that can go wrong, highlighting our limits, not our capabilities. Peace and stabilization operations are often suffused with a savior complex, the idea that we're going to come in from the outside and we're going to put it all right because they can't put it all right. Because, look at how well we order our politics and our societies. Research on peace operations show that outside actors are important. They can help stabilize war-torn countries, but they're actually relatively minor. The really important actors are local actors who have live and die interests at stake. And at times we get far too focused on what it is we're bringing to the party, fail to recognize we're actually quite small part of the party. We've also been a bit misled by Iraq and Afghanistan, which have far more resources than we have in most peace and stabilization operations. The norm is DRC, Mali, Central African Republic. But since 9/11, we've fallen to the thought that peace and stabilization operations involve spending trillions of dollars and putting lots of boots on the ground. And look how well that's worked out. And they typically don't. And understand that you'll be played if you're the outside actors. People will spend a lot of time working out how to play you. Having worked at times for the host government, I have contributed to ideas on how to play my own country. Who you should talk to, what the right messaging is, what'll get the money out of the donor, and so forth. They're not dumb. They're working. They know how to pull things. Barwick Green, which is one of Jim Wolman's designs, I absolutely love, because in Barwick Green, it's a British village after the British Civil War in which Bangladeshi peacekeepers are trying to make peace. And they don't understand anything about British village life. And they can only talk to the locals through the translator who's a Brit of Asian heritage from South London who neither understands Bangladesh nor British villages, but has to pretend to both sides that he's the expert. Whilst in the version I saw is having a relationship with the owner of one of the pubs. And it's great because at the end of it, you realize that the peacekeepers have entirely misunderstood. The secret meetings occurring once a week in the church are actually organizing the village fate, right? They're not really, and that the reason they can't find the weapons transfers is it's a boot-to-boot transfer in the back parking lot of the pub, which is the one place where the Bangladeshi peacekeepers are not allowed to go. And the sounds of shooting you hear from the woods at night, this was my favorite, are not snipers, it's the poacher and the gamekeeper, and so on and so forth. And it's brilliant in highlighting you don't know everything, you don't understand what's going on, have a realistic sense of what you can bring to the table. Remember the Kobayashi Maru? War involves difficult moral challenges, and peace and stabilization operations involve particularly difficult ones. And I think it's important to prepare people for those difficult choices. Now, famously in Star Trek, it's the unwinnable scenario until James T. Kirk cheats, but that doesn't save Spock, who dies anyway, although he doesn't really. But there's all kinds of difficult choices in real wars. Sexual and gender-based violence issues. Chinese peacekeepers were roundly condemned in South Sudan for not leaving their camp to rescue NGO workers who were being raped down the street by militias. Maybe that was a wrong call, but they had no information on who was there, who was armed, and a bunch of Chinese peacekeepers coming out of a camp headed 4K down the road were at very high risk of being ambushed. Maybe that was the reason that the assaults were occurring. These are difficult choices. Srebrenica. The reason I have that story on the right, I couldn't find the original reporting at the time. When the fighting first broke out in the CAR, South Africa had some forces deployed there, and they were confronted with hundreds of child soldiers, some as young as 10, coming at them, and had to decide whether they wanted to open fire or not open fire. And they may have killed scores, possibly more than 100 young children. And the PTSD effects and so forth in the SADF were quite severe. There's no good choice there. Maybe there is, but it's actually a really hard choice. And I think it's a good idea to beat your participants up with some really hard choices before they get there and have them think through their decision process. Why did I make that difficult choice? What made it operationally or morally right? And what happens if morally right and operationally right are not pulling in exactly the same direction and so forth. The reference to Camp 7 and Camp 9 is I have some, in my Brynäs simulation, there are two IDP camps, internally displaced camps, that the government runs, which in fact are pretty nasty internment camps for the ethnic minority, in which there's information sprinkled lightly in the sim, which if people put things together, they'll work out, but it usually takes them a couple months to work out. But the problem is making an issue of it often torpedoes the peace process. If you force the government to talk about it, they walk away from the table because they don't want war crimes investigations. And it does not have any, there's no answer, there's no easy answer about what you do. I think there's a better answer and there's a worse answer, but there's no easy answer. And I do extensive debriefs. One of the things that comes up is International Committee of the Red Cross often gets to do an investigation of the camp. ICRC does not disclose the results of its investigations to anyone other than the host government. That's an ICRC policy, which is why they get access to detention all over the world. What do you do if you're an ICRC delegate and you see evidence of mass executions in a camp? And you tell the government and they don't do anything because they're the ones doing the mass executions. Do you go public and compromise ICRC access all over the world for the next 20 years? Or do you shut up and people are going to be shot in the camp every day? Or is there some creative solution, but there's not an option? It's a really difficult choice. And it's one, frankly, the ICRC delegates face all the time, because they have a mechanism which makes a lot of sense, but it does sometimes mean that they can't talk about atrocities that they've seen that are not yet in the public domain. So some final thoughts. I'm over by 7 minutes. I think Free Kriegspiel is quite useful because it allows you to deal with that complexity and the uncertainty and the politicization. It's very hard to anticipate all of this in a rigid game design. So rigid game designs are good if you have particular lessons you want to teach, but there's a reason why I run a week-long Free Kriegspiel. Genuine diversity in your participant group is, I think, very important in getting multiple perspectives on these things. I think there's value of a big green, little blue, ambiguous red. So we should actually be relatively weak. There should be a giant, complex host country dynamic, and it should not be clear who red is. I mean, we often call them red. Who's red? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? That is not always perfectly clear in these situations, or red can change. So play the locals as major actors, not just someone who sort of drops in to add some local color to your peace and stabilization game. And the importance of semi-cooperative game design, it's very hard to get that sweet point where most of the actors are on the same side, but they're failing to cooperate. It's easy to design a purely cooperative game. It's easy to design a purely adversarial game. That point in between of cooperative with friction and cooperation that breaks down is a really core design focus. Final point I'll make, because I'm just going to do some advertising, that if any of you want to come to Montreal in February, and next time you come to Canada, bring your coat like I told you, Tom. He was going to Florida afterwards, so he thought his windbreaker would do ho. Connections North is going to be held at McGill University of Montreal on the 15th of February 2020, and the registration details will eventually be on PAX Sims. They're not there yet. So with that, I am finished. Thank you.